You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Tom Rowe, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. We're coming to you with live classical music tonight.
It was near the woods where I lived when I grew up. On one side there was a psychiatric hospital, a veterans hospital, and our parents would tell us not to go into the woods too late because sometimes a patient would escape. Sometimes one of them would wander off, wander out of their room in their hospital gown, removing their IVs, and coming through the woods into our neighborhood. But for us, we never heeded the warning, you know. We thought it was just our parents being overprotective, so we would throw parties in the woods, keggers and whatnot. It was often on Saturday nights we would all convene deep in the veterans' woods. And, you know, many parties went off without a hitch. No police, no fights, just teenagers having fun. An average Saturday night in the suburbs. But in October 1994, all that changed. It was a kid we knew. His name was Keith, and he thought he was a real hot shot. You know, he always was in charge of getting the keg and bringing it into the woods, and he always had the coolest new clothes, polo at the time, and he seemed to be fearless. You know, he grew up in those woods, so he would brag and knew him like the back of his hand. He would ride dirt bikes there, and his brother would paint satanic stars on rocks and listen to heavy metal. And they were really looked up to in the community as, you know, some heavy partiers. But what we never expected was that Keith and his brother would fall victim to a circumstance that we had been warned about. It seemed that one of these patients had wandered out, maybe in a fit of rage, maybe not knowing what he was doing, but I guess, you know, Keith had wandered off from the party. He'd been smoking, drinking, and I don't know if he was with a girl or thought he was going to play a trick on us, but he wandered off. And we found him. We found him the next day. And, well, what was left of him. And it was a brutal scene. So there was an investigation. The kids knew, the kids of the town knew that it was an escaped mental patient that had done it. But we still partied in those woods after that, even after Keith died.
Met in New Mexico and fell in love in New Mexico. And they rented this house, this giant house out in Taos, and they would have these artist colonies come every summer. They would have all these artist residents come at night and stay there for weeks at a time. And my mom would always, I grew up hearing these stories, these scary stories about the house, about how shit would just go up the stairs. Books would fly open and, you know, things would knock over in the middle of the night. But the scariest story she ever told me was the one about the origins of the house. And the story is as follows. So Mabel Dodge was the heiress to the Dodge fortune. And she grew up in New York and was sort of part of the Paris in the 20s social art scene and travel over. O'Keefe and Steamlet. She wanted to be a pioneer in the West, so she decided to move to New Mexico. So she moved to New Mexico, and she ended up shortly thereafter meeting Tony Lujan, who was the son of the Penitente Indian chief. And she and Tony Lujan and it was truly a star. They weren't supposed to be together. He was supposed to marry somebody from his tribe, and she was supposed to, I don't know, marry somebody rich. But there was no star. So they fell in love, and Tony sort of separated from his tribe and went and lived with her. And because she was so wealthy, she was able to do whatever she wanted. And she decided that because she was so wealthy and by his culture, that she could build a house right adjacent. Pueblo. So she built this giant adobe house, and she could sort of see what was going on in Pueblo, but nobody was very happy about it. And she would do really inappropriate things, and she didn't care, like collect death cards and all kinds of artifacts and texts that she wasn't supposed to have. And people would come and beg her to, you know, give them up and not have them, because it was really inappropriate. And not only did she keep them, but she decided to build a spire on top of her house. And apparently, at the time, the Penitente was still sacrificing people. And so she built this tower to watch the sacrifices. So you can imagine that she was, you know, fallen into great disrespect with the Indians there. And she didn't care. she just did it anyway. And people would come to her and tell her that she was cursed and come to her and tell her that she needed to get rid of stuff, and she wouldn't. And she and Tony lived together and lived out their days, and Tony passed away long before she did. And soon after Tony passed away, she started having night terrors. And the night terrors at first were intense, and she said that there was one specific woman who would come visit her, who was really, the dreams were really real. And she said that if the woman didn't look like she was absolutely from another era, that she would be sure that she was awake, because they were so visceral. And she kept having these night terrors for a long time, and eventually they turned really violent. And they turned so violent to the point where she would wake up with rage. She'd have bruises, and she would have scratches. Sometimes she'd have her hair. So her friends, of which there were many around the town, decided that she absolutely needed to see a doctor, and doctors would come to her bedside and talk to her, and certainly ruled that it was schizophrenia or some kind of self-inflicted pain. She just denied it the entire time and said that there was, in fact, a woman that would come and threaten her in her sleep, and this woman was the woman of the tribe. And eventually it turned so bad that she would get broken bones, and she would just wake up with terrible, terrible pain and terrible injuries. And one morning, one of her friends, who was a renowned archaeologist and a native scholar in the area, decided that it was getting so bad that he needed to come and, you know, sort of like knock some sense into her and talk to her and get her some help. So this scholar came to the house, and he, sure enough, she wouldn't answer the door. And he went up to this room, the room where she had had all these night terrors. And she was dead in her bed with an arrow through her head and signs of struggle. And because the archaeologist was a scholar and was so schooled in Native American studies, he was able to determine that the arrowhead was in fact from 100 years prior to their existence. And to this day, the story is confirmed that Mabel Dodge was haunted by a Native ghost and killed by the same ghost.
On the campus of Miami University, there's a particular dorm room far to the west, nestled in the woods, in a pleasant, beautiful green area, where a ghost roams. This is her tale. Ellen Peabody was the president of Western University in the 1800s. She was starkly against co-education, and the campus of Miami University nearby, which was attended by many young men studying business, often resulted in her lecturing these boys about coming over to the Western Women's Campus. She was known for her cold stare, her fiery anger. Many students experienced this in her tenure on campus. Many students experienced this even 100 years later on campus as she roamed the halls of Peabody Hall. I went to the attic one night because I had some friends that lived in that dorm. We all dismissed the stories about the showers coming on, strange experiences with the televisions and electronics in the dorm room. We were just having fun, drinking, hanging out. I happen to know the attic access for the facility. We knew that we could get to the roof. We just had to pass through the huge oak cisterns that were still there because it was a historic building site. Everything had to be maintained. There were stories of students swimming in these cisterns, even silly little legendary ghost stories about so-and-so drowned so many years ago. I don't know if any of those were true. But as we climbed through these timbered attics, passing by the huge oak cisterns, no longer in service, empty of any water, but obviously quite ancient. Down the walkway towards the roof hatch that would be just around the corner in the attic, there was a light. All five of us were together. We knew the route. A few other students did, even those that lived in the hall. And it just flickered for an instant. We dismissed it as an illusion, us fooling ourselves. Everyone knew the stories of Mrs. Peabody in the hall. The painting that would watch you if you had done something that she would disapprove of. Students said she would blink as you walked by. So we continued on, just up around the corner. The narrow planks creaked a little bit, but I knew the way well. We came up on the roof and hung out, drank some beers. It's a very pleasant spring night. All was carefree. No one thought about any glimmer of any superstition in the attic on our way out. Eventually it was time to return. Most of the friends ventured on ahead. Myself and another friend were a little laden, just shortly behind the group. As I came down the ladder and carefully closed the hatch, we didn't want any trace of our roaming on the roofs. Surely this would not be approved by the campus police. Latched everything up behind me, descended. We walked down the narrow planks. We had flashlights with us. I knew the attic would be dark. Everyone else had already made it out clearly. There was no light at the entrance in the center of the attic. As we came around the corner, we could peer down through the maybe 6 or 8 cisterns that lined the massive interior roof of the dormitory. And again, there was a flicker, almost a candlelight, probably almost 20 meters away. but it was there for only an instant. And as I realized that my friend had seen it as well, she was clutching my arm with such force. Our feet clattered down the wooden planks across the massive beams of the floor. The hatch seemed impossible to open. We were probably through it in seconds. It felt like an eternity. And as I slammed it shut and stood in the fluorescent lit institutional hallway that had been created, the chill ran so deep down my spine. I couldn't explain when I saw that fine evening. So much of it was so wonderful and pleasant. But the stories of Peabody Hall forever carry such weight. In another college town, 10 years earlier, there was a girl named Bethany, and she finished up her math class at the university, packed up her book bag, and walked to a payphone and called her friends and said, "All right, it's on." And the plan was that they were going to, you know, that Friday night after a long week of studying and, like, you know, cramming for exams, they were going to roast some marshmallows in the dorms, like, after classes. So they got the goods on the way to the dorms, stopped up and got some graham crackers and marshmallows and chocolate Hershey bars, and brought it back to the dorms. And Bethany was the one who had the gas stove, which is really strictly against university regulations, but they were going for it anyway. So they broke open the Hershey bars and got going, and they lit up the stove too, but what happened is the stove tipped over and lit Bethany on fire.
in a one gesture, as she lit the stove, just as their other friends were unpacking everything, and it started like a little flame, but there was some sort of polyester. Clothing that she was wearing, and before she knew it, her entire body was just like lit up, like the marshmallows that they were planning to burn on the stove later. And she lit up and tried rolling around, but there was nothing that she could do to put it out. And her three friends that gathered in the room with her to roast marshmallows weren't able to do anything about it. They just stood there paralyzed with fear, not really moving, but not really even registering what's happening to their friend Bethany. And she's lit up like a falling flame. She's screaming and yelling and running down the... And they weren't doing anything at all to help Bethany. And she's just like a burning star of flames, polyester, cotton mix, hairspray, nightmare, running down the halls. And so it was the most horrible night anyone could ever remember. And after lots of counseling and meetings and college regulations and contractors and fix-it men and whatever, they kind of, life went back to normal. And, you know, there was a horrible funeral where nobody knew what to say. And nobody could believe that it even happened. And before you knew it, like I was saying, like, life was back to normal. Basically, every couple months, a couple girls tried to live in that room the next year after they fixed it up. And every couple months, the girls would see a burn mark on the door in the shape of her face. I mean, it was kind of like they were pretending that it was her face. It was definitely a burn mark, you know, that appeared near the handle, and they kind of just like, you know, rationalized that it kind of looked like a face, and it does, you know, and they have all these photographs of it, and nobody could believe that, and they basically, like, people freak out and be like, I'm not living in here, and then, you know, next semester some people that didn't know about the story would move in, and they'd see the burn mark again, over and over again, and, you know, they were just replacing the door every time someone would report that there were burns on the door. And one time, a woman was there during summer school, and she didn't know about the story, and late at night, she smelled a burning smell kind of on the second floor where Bethany had been running around screaming like a burning mess. a hunk of burning mess. She didn't know that story, and she smelled this burning smell. And she went upstairs to check it out. And as she opened one of those old-fashioned sort of like college swinging, like sprung swinging doors with the metal push thing, she kind of opened that. And when the swinging sound stopped, she heard the screaming sound start. She didn't know what it was. And she turned around, turned the other way, and all of a sudden there's this burning ball of Bethany coming at her. Helping me.
This tale begins in Sausalito, the sausage creature. It's bro. John was a bad man. He was the wildest biker in town. Big long hair. He was mean. Nobody would mess with him. He liked to ride his bike up and down the highways, visiting each one of his sweethearts, his precious little buddies, as he called them. He had wild, wild, wild eyes, and he rode his wild motorcycle with no shirt. No pants. No boots. Almost naked to show off his beautiful wild body. One day, he was riding his bike through the twisty, curving roads along the coast, and his bike spun out of control. He flipped over, rolling along the ground, skidding himself, dragging little pieces of flesh upon every single hit and bounce. All his flesh was torn off, but he was too mean to die. He ran into the woods screaming, fleshless. He had become a sausage creature. But he was too mean. Too mean to die. Normally a man would bleed to death. After a big skid like that on the road. But as he was running through the woods, he collected little bits of leaves, dirt, rocks, twigs, bushes would stick to him, and it became his new flesh. He became a sausage creature of the woods. Driven insane by the fear, you could hear his cries at night. And he's out there, all right. He's out there still, looking for young campers, young lovers, people in cars, looking to take their skin. Take out his twig skin and add it to his real skin. Make their skin his own because he's still got a couple of honeys waiting for him. And as soon as he gets that new skin, he's gonna ride his big old bike over there and say hello to his special buddies. That sausage creature's mean, big bad Bill with the wild hair and the no flesh. You can hear him scream even now. Beware the sausage man of Sausalito.
So this story is about when we're in Australia with our friend Bo, and he's like, "All right, guys, I gotta take you guys to this cave. It's the scariest cave, you know, we're ever gonna go to, right?" So we're like, "All right, fuck, we'll go to it." And we're in Gold Coast, which is like the Florida of Australia. It's like fucking... It's like, it's like old people, because as you go north in Australia, it's like going south in America, it gets beachier. So, we're in this weird, kind of like swampy, but hilly, like jungle-ish part of Australia. And my friend Bo's like, "I'll take you to these caves, the glowworm caves." And there's glowworms on the ceiling, but, you know, you're not allowed to be there at night, there's no lights. So we're going into the mountains, into the hills of Australia. It's like, I'd never been there before. we're going higher and higher. We're telling ghost stories the whole way. He's like, kids have died in here, you know? He's like, so many kids were diving in, and they were hitting their head, and everyone died in here. But it was seriously like an ancient cave, and in Australia, you know, you've seen like Aboriginal stuff. It's like super ancient vibes. Like, I don't know, it was just weird. So we're psyching ourselves out the entire ride up, and just getting more and more scared as we drive up and up this like fucking mountain to get to this cave. So we get there and we're like, all right, we're here, and it's like, does anyone have a light? And we're like, no. We had like, at the time, like a flip phone. So we're walking down these trails to get to this cave, and all of a sudden we can hear that there's a waterfall, and the waterfall comes into the cave, through the ceiling. There's a hole in the ceiling that was cut, and so the water's like this intense sound, and we walk into the cave, and the entire ceiling is like this pulsating beams of light of these glowworms, and it was just so dark that each of us, there was five of us, but we couldn't see each other, and we're all in a room similar, you know, to the circle that we're in now, but it felt like we were miles apart, and there was like an energy in this cave that was almost like more intense than like the most intense mosh pit that I had ever been in, and just like pitch black dark, but like such a swirling array of energy in this cave in Australia with these glowworms, and you know, you could just feel more energy in this cave, and like maybe I haven't experienced like a spirit or an apparition appearing to me, but I could feel like eons, like an eternity of energy in this cave, and everything that had gone on, and every person that had come and gone, died and lived and drank and whatever in this cave, but the energy that was concentrated in this one spot, in this remote area of Australia that I had been on, it was the most intense experience, paranormal experience of my life. So I guess it's not technically a ghost story, but I could feel the presence of more than just the five of us at that time. So I would say that even though it might not be so scary, you know, that there's things that we don't understand. So no sense in really being scared of that. Yeah. I'd like to thank everybody. This is about to end our transmission. Alright, here's the last scary part.
And I hope you take it with you when you die. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Tom, that ends our transmission. Remote audio outpost. Thank you. Good.